Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's the bad news in the polls in Mexico. Almost 60% of Mexicans think the drug cartels are winning Mexico's war on drugs. Washington may fear the same. Yesterday, practically the entire top tier of America's security apparatus descended on Mexico City. It was a major statement on a big problem. U.S. drug demand drives the drug trade. But where are the drug cartels driving Mexico? This hour on Point, Mexico and the deep reach of the drug cartels. You can join the conversation. Have American demand for drugs and American weapons built a narco state right on our border? And now what? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Mexico City is Alfredo Corchado. He is a Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. Alfredo, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
Remind us who all was there yesterday from Washington. That was quite a lineup.
It was quite a lineup. The delegation was headed by Hillary Clinton, other secretaries, including Janet Napolitano. He had the head of the Pentagon, Robert Gates, the admiral, Mullins, the head of intelligence. I mean, it wasn't really what the words were, but really who showed up that I think was a clear indication that the Obama administration is pretty concerned about the situation in Mexico and the deteriorating a security problem in Mexico.
And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen, who's certainly got a lot else going on in the world, but there he was right next door in Mexico. Give us a rundown, Alfredo, on what they're looking at that would lead them to have this heightened concern. What are the elements that make up Washington's, you know, fear about what's happening in Mexico?
Well, real quick, I mean, President Calderon started this war 4 years ago, and the toll so far is 18,000 people have been killed. There are hundreds of communities that are now considered pockets of lawlessness, communities that are essentially controlled by drug cartels. And it's a problem that's growing away from the U.S.-Mexico border. I mean, that's still the ground zero for the violence. But you're seeing many, many more communities, important communities, including the second most powerful city in Mexico, Monterrey, that was essentially held hostage by paramilitary groups last week when they burned buses right in the main thoroughfare that disrupts trade between the United States and Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge, huge sense of concern. And I guess the biggest problem they have is that there's really no sense of whether the strategy will work long term. I mean, it's not real sustainable. So they came down, they talked about expanding the media initiative into doing more than just focusing on going after cartels. They talked about, for example, increasing U.S. support for training Mexican police officers, judges, prosecutors, public defenders. In other words, trying to build up the institutions, the rule of law. They're focusing on border enforcement efforts, on systems that will allow goods and people to be screened before they reach the crossing points. In other words, what they call a 21st century border, where the flow of goods can go back and forth and in a very secure way. And perhaps more importantly, they talked about resilient communities. In other words, supporting Mexican programs aimed at strengthening economies in border cities that are plagued by crime and poverty. Of the 18,000 people that I mentioned,
yes, dead, killed.
The majority of the victims are under the age of 30. So there's a lot of young people who have no job opportunities, and they're very vulnerable to the cartels tempting them with quick cash and often quick death.
Alfredo, after all that scale of trouble, was it really the killing, these three killings in Ciudad Juarez 10 days ago that brought them down there? I mean, this was a U.S. consulate employee and her husband, American citizens, and the Mexican husband of another employee at the consulate, all killed on the way home from a children's birthday party. Is that what got all these top officials, you know, off their chairs and down to Mexico City?
Well, the officials will tell you that the trip was planned long before the consulate killings. but that it did create a new sense of urgency. And at one point they talked about having the meeting somewhere outside Mexico City. After the Council of Killings, they wanted to send a statement. They wanted to come to the nation's capital and make that statement and also meet with the president and say, look, in spite of what's going on, in spite of you losing support, we stand by you.
Here's Hillary Clinton yesterday, Alfredo, in Mexico City.
We have watched with great grief the terrible tragedies and murders that have taken place here in Mexico. And then our hearts were broken by the murders in Juarez, which took the lives of three people connected to our consulate. They were but the latest horrible reminder of how much we have to do together and how crucial these meetings are.
Alfredo, these are only 3 out of 18,000 deaths in this drug war, as you say. It's a small number, but it is curious. Is it clear why apparently Mexican gangs went after people related to the U.S. consulate there? What was going on? Is this intimidation? Are they trying to? It's been done with American Mexican officials all over. Are they trying it now with American officials in Mexico?
Well, officially, the Mexican authorities say, you know, there's something there. They're not saying exactly what it is. I mean, they suggest that they perhaps targeted the Americans, insist it was a case of mistaken identity. But if you talk to American law enforcement officials, they really don't buy that. I mean, they think it could be a result of the, well, the increasing U.S. role in Mexico. Whether or not that's true, I mean, the investigation continues. We can't really say clearly one or the other. But, Tom, I think what is interesting about this is that for the first time it really reveals the depth and complexity of the role that the United States plays in the violent narcotics trade in Mexico. I mean, you've had American officials in El Paso, which is considered one of the safest cities in America.
Right across the border from Ciudad Juarez, yep.
Juarez, exactly. They detain more than 200 gang members of a group known as Barrio Azteca. At least 28 of them have been arrested. So it shows you just, you know, these cartels on the Mexican side can't really operate without U.S. demand, without U.S. cash, without U.S. weapons, and without hitmen, you know, coming from the United States.
What does it mean that so many Mexicans don't think the government is winning the drug war? You remind us that, 58.5% of Mexicans say the government, the Calderon government's not winning. Only 22% or so say it is. What's that about?
Well, it really puts a lot of pressure on the United States government to try to show results, because I think what they fear the most is that after Calderon is out of office, you know, 2.5 years from now, nearly 3 years from now, the ruling institutional party may come back and regain power, and they may go back to a system of accommodation where the cartels will continue operating kind of in a don't ask, no tell kind of policy. And the fear is that that sense of policy was basically corrupting the entire government. So, you know, the fear of the United States is we can have a failed country long-term next to us.
We're going to hear later in this hour from former Mexican Foreign Minister Jorge Castaneda, who essentially says that I think that's what they should go back to. We'll ask him. But speaking of don't ask, don't tell, Alfredo, there's also a don't ask, don't tell policy being discussed around American intelligence operatives in Mexico. What does that mean? Mexico's saying, come on in, do your work, whatever it is. We don't want to know about it. Don't, you know, we won't ask, you won't tell us, but get in here with the American intelligence. It's like, sounds like a new Pakistan.
Well, you have a long history of U.S. Involvement in Mexico. So anytime you use the word military or operational activities, you will hear cries of nationalism and,
sure,
and loss of sovereignty. So, you know, Mexicans are very, very sensitive. But what's interesting is that if you ask people that in Mexico City, yes, the sensitivity is still there, still very raw. Ask people along the U.S.-Mexico border, and it's like, bring the Americans. I mean, at one massacre that we've covered, the victims, the relatives of the victims, did not want to talk to Mexican authorities. They only wanted to focus on American authorities because they wanted results. So it's a debate that's really going on in Mexico right now, and it's going on all over the country.
Here's Hillary Clinton again yesterday in Mexico City with that incredible entourage saying there's a big American responsibility here around demand for drugs and weapons, which tend to come in this war from the United States.
We know that the demand for drugs drives much of this illicit trade, that guns purchased in the United States, as we saw some of the examples outside, are used to facilitate violence here in Mexico. And the United States must and is doing its part to help you and us meet those challenges.
Alfredo Corchado in Mexico City, how do Mexicans look at this? Do they say, we've got to clean up our problem here, or the United States is making this problem with its demand, with its easy weapons market?
Well, if you look at the press here and the way the media played it immediately afterwards, I mean, their main focus is Clinton acknowledges U.S. role. Clinton acknowledges that guns are bad for Mexico, which is fine. But you know, a lot of analysts, a lot of experts will say Mexicans need to also hold their own people accountable. I mean, it is a shared problem. It is a co-responsibility. And blaming the United States for everything is not going to get them anywhere anymore.
Does it feel to you in Mexico City like this is a narco state or a cartel-controlled country behind the scenes or not?
This has been brewing for years, and I think clearly it is now the front and center issue. And when you look at the images of buses blocking major highways, you look at the council of killings, you look at the ongoing massacres across the country, you realize that, you know, it makes people, at least psychologically, feel like we're not winning. This is not going anywhere. What do we do now?
Alfredo Corchado, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. It's always great to talk with you. Thank you, Alfredo.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Mexico and the reach of the drug cartels, just how deep, just how murderous in Mexico, in Latin America, in the USA. We just heard from Mexico City. In a few moments, we'll hear from the former foreign minister of Mexico, Jorge Castañeda. Right now, we're joined from Washington by Samuel Logan. He's a journalist and security analyst, well-known in intelligence circles, lived and worked in Latin America for a long time, senior writer for the International Relations and Security Network, founding editor of the online security report Southern Pulse Networked Intelligence. He's also America's regional manager for IJET Intelligence Risk Systems, author of This Is for the Mara Salvatrucha, Inside the MS-13, America's Most Violent Gang. Sam Logan, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Everybody tells us you're plugged in 17 ways to what's going on in Mexico. Where do you see the balance of power running? How big, how deep is the hold of the cartels on Mexico now?
Well, I think when you look at it from a 40,000-foot view, looking down at everything, trying to figure mm-hmm. out what pieces are moving and who are the major power brokers, one of the first names that comes to mind is Joaquin Guzman, known as El Chapo in Mexico. He's been listed in Forbes as a billionaire. He's been widely written up across the region. He is definitely a major power broker. And inside the criminal underworld, he would be sort of Calderon's counterpart. Calderon would obviously be on the legal side of things, another major power broker. But beneath these two men, you have on both the legal and the illegal side of the fence a whole number of individuals who are all competing for power. Both within the Mexican military and the Mexican Justice Department, Mexican Federal Police, but also in rival cartels that fight against El Chapo, namely Los Zetas, the Beltrán Leyva organization. You have the Juarez cartel, the Tijuana cartel. So there's a lot of moving parts.
But you're describing President Calderon there as just, in a way, another power broker among drug cartel power brokers.
Well,
is that an overstatement?
I don't think so. If you consider the just look at it from the perspective of how much power he has to bring to bear on the situation. In terms of money, I don't think he's spending nearly as much as what the cartels have at their disposal to spend to fight against him. If you take a conservative estimate, these guys, El Chapo and the rest, are bringing maybe as much as $8 billion a year south of the border to bring to bear on their defenses and their networks and so on. I don't think Calderon is spending near that much. If you look at Caledon support in Washington, President Obama, I think, has set aside around $310 billion for fiscal year 2011. So just if you look at how much, you know, each side is spending, it gives you an idea.
You've described what's going on with cartels now as the third generation cartels or gangs, 3G. What does that mean?
Well, the idea of a third-generation gang was one developed, I believe, by John Sullivan over at the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. The idea there being a first-generation street gang, and this is something separate from the drug trafficking organizations that are also known as cartels. First-generation street gang would be one where they have an identity, they have tattoos, they wear a certain color.
Right, sure.
There is a culture. The second generation would be there's an active business model, whether that be extortion, drug trafficking, so on. Third generation would be where you have de facto political control over entire communities. One of the gangs that I've looked at a lot, the Marisao Trucha, the MS-13, does have that sort of third generation gang political control, business model, and culture, and exerts that control over entire swaths of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, for example. In Mexico, the situation is a little bit different. Because the street gangs, as Alfredo mentioned earlier in the segment, they work directly with the Mexican drug trafficking organizations. So their business model in a lot of cases is not only extortion and drug trafficking, but also hired assassins on both sides of the border.
So when you say political control as part of a business model, does that presume that they, with a combination of, I don't know, money and intimidation, that they own the officials, or is there a big percentage of official Mexico that's fighting back, that's straight, that's not tainted by that?
Well, yeah, that's a hard number to try and draw up, or a line in the sand to try and draw. If you consider a group like the Zetas, which is by its own rights a drug trafficking organization, but also just an organized criminal group, they're one of the largest employers up until maybe February of this year. Of individuals in the cities of Matamoros and Reynosa. I'm talking about thousands of people that they've employed. And that includes municipal police. That includes state and city-level politicians, deputies, as they're called in Mexico in most cases, mayors, in some cases governors. But the line is drawn at the federal level in a lot of cases in my research and from what I've learned. Because they'll say, well, if you're going to go to the federal level, go to Mexico City, represent this state, that's fine, we'll leave you alone. But when you come back after you've had your successful campaign and your successful time in Mexico City, maybe you'll come back here and you'll be a prosecutor, you'll be a governor, you'll be a judge, you'll be head of the federal police force. That's when we're going to go after you.
And of course,
that's when we're going to give you the infamous decision of lead or silver, plata or plomo.
Lead or silver, a bullet or some the money that may come from the trade. And, of course, that's back on the ground. That's where government happens. That's where people live. I'm reading here people saying that it's not just drugs, that Mexican cartels, the UN classifies 23 different types of activity that organized criminals around the world specialize in. And this is saying here, this is in the Financial Times, Mexican cartels are involved in 22 of the 23. The only one they've missed, apparently it says here, is trafficking in nuclear material. Like, so what else besides drugs?
Well, if you read some of the analysis coming out of Mexico recently, there have been some rather strong voices with connections to the United Nations saying that, collectively speaking, these drug trafficking organizations only have about 48% of their business portfolio invested in the drug trade. So that's 52% that they do for extortions. They're robbing cargo. They're involved in human trafficking. They're also involved in what I've called the troll under the bridge type of business arrangement in Mexico. They call it derecho de piso, which essentially means if you're a criminal and you're crossing over land that I control, you pay me a percentage of whatever you're earning through that action. So if you cross my bridge, I'm the troll under the bridge. You got to pay me to cross it.
I mean, this gets to a scale that's pretty amazing. Cargo theft, I'm reading it. This is from Kroll. They say in 2009, cargo theft was up 40%. Criminal gangs tightened their grip on the country's highways and railways with a kind of shadow supply chain. And they've got numbers here for the number of criminals involved in cargo theft. It looks like, I don't know, something... you know, up around 25,000. That's a lot of cargo going into the shadow world.
Yeah, and that's what's reported, Tom. There's a whole lot of stuff that, you know, in terms of the trafficking, the kidnapping, the cargo theft, there's a whole lot of stuff that's not reported. So the numbers that we're seeing are usually pretty conservative for what's actually going on.
Wow. Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska, if we can. And Ricardo. Ricardo, you're on the air with Sam Logan.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call.
Certainly.
And the point I'm trying to make, I was born and raised in Mexico. I lived in the second largest city, which, Guadalajara.
Uh-huh.
What I see, it's a supply and demand problem. You have the biggest supplier next to the biggest consumer.
Supplier is in Mexico, consumer as in the U.S. market for drugs.
Well, Mexico as a supplier, mm-hmm. the United States as the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole problem is, like, we're trying to educate Mexicans. Mexicans know about it. You know, I lived there. I was born and raised there. And the problem has been going on for generations. You know, like when the PRA was in power, this was, as your, you know, one of your guest speakers said, it was don't ask, don't tell. But it's always been there under the surface because the government, in one way, just looked the other way.
And
what I'm trying to say, legalizing it will just marijuana itself. And for the record, I'm not a recreational smoker.
Right.
But for the record, legalizing it will focus the resources where they need to be focused in enforcement, law enforcement. Because there's not enough DEA agents just to, you know, go after the marijuana growers, which they're growing marijuana, as we speak, on American public park land.
Right. Even there, not enough agents in the world. Ricardo, thanks for your perspective. Sam Logan, how about it? We've got a lot of callers making a similar point. Legalize and unplug the big profitable trade for the drug lords. But Hillary Clinton was asked about that in Mexico City yesterday, and she said straight up, no, no.
Well, there's traditionally speaking, within political circles in the United States and certainly in Europe in some pockets, there is sort of a political inertia against legalization of any drug. That largely comes out of the UN, United Nations mm-hmm. agreements made many, many years ago. But if you consider the fact that 42% of their business portfolio comes from all drug trafficking, that includes marijuana, cocaine, methamphetamines, mm-hmm. heroin, black tar heroin mostly, mm-hmm. you take away 42%, they'll just increase their activities on the other side. They're not going to go away. Legalization has been discussed in Brazil as well, for example, just as a parenthetical statement here. And one of the arguments there was, okay, let's legalize cocaine and marijuana in the city of Rio. Well, then what would happen is if, you know, you take that economic incentive away from all of the gangs in Rio and suddenly have tens of thousands of individuals, you know, well-armed descending into the streets to make money some other way.
But what if the alternative, and maybe it's not so black and white, I guess you're saying it's not, but it can look like the alternative, is something like a narco state across the border, 18,000 dead in just a handful of years here, control at the border really in question. I mean, legalizing drugs is not on a lot of people's wish list, that's for sure. Mm. But a narco state next door with the government itself, a bunch of it in the pocket of criminal gangs doesn't look like a good option either.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. The alternative to legalization is one that is not a quick fix. A lot of people, I think, look at legalization or perhaps decriminalization as something that would be a quick fix. If you consider the alternative, look at comparing Mexico to Colombia. It's hard not to do in this case. It took a protracted and very costly effort on part of the United States on many different levels through Plan Colombia to reduce the amount of violence in that country. And by large amounts, that the violence has been reduced. But Colombia is still exporting just as much cocaine as it did 10 years ago,
wow.
with variations through the years. Yep. But, you know.
Sam, stand by, if you would, there in Washington. We're joined right now from Colorado, and very happy to be, by Jorge Castañeda, former Mexican foreign minister under Vicente Fox from 2000 to 2003. He's now a professor of politics and Latin American studies at New York University, senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Minister Castañeda, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
What do you think of the big descent of all these American top brass on Mexico City yesterday? Does that give you hope that something stronger, more effective, better is brewing here or not?
Well, not really. I understand the purpose of the second meeting of the high-level group, which is really more a reset of an old group that was founded in 1980 called the Binational Commission, which meets once a year on all sorts of issues. So now they set up a special one just for drugs. I see the purpose of it, which is to go to Mexico and to support President Calderon's failed war on drugs. He doesn't have a whole lot of other support anymore other than the United States and the Obama administration, so I'm sure he's very grateful for that support. And I think it's useful for the Mexican people to see that even if they are more and more incredulous and skeptical about all of this, at least President Obama still thinks it's a great idea.
Jorge Castaneda, you're a big critic, and we hear it already, of the war on drugs, and you're quoted as saying that President Calderon should have sort of left well enough alone. Yes, there was a lot of drug trade. Yes, there were a lot of corrupt officials, but the drug war has made it worse. Why? How?
Well, that it's made it worse, I don't think is arguable at this stage. More than 18,000 people have died in these 3 years in drug-related executions, and we see no improvement either in the sense of security that the Mexican people have, or in the levels of violence, which have gone way up, or in the control of the territory by the Mexican army. One of the main reasons that was given back in 2006 for going to war was that the government had lost control of important parts of Mexico's territory.
Yes.
Well, it's got less control today than it did then. It doesn't control Ciudad Juarez, it doesn't control Tamaulipas, it doesn't control all sorts of places, and it's arguable that it didn't really control them then. So, quite frankly, whatever the arguments were made then in favor of this war, none of them have worked. We managed to deal with this issue for the previous 40 or 50 years, partly by looking by the other way, partly by making some deals with some cartels some of the time against other cartels other parts of the time, partly by containing the issue, and partly by ensuring that everybody was pretty much okay with this, and when the Americans were not okay, we would hand over some sacrificial lamb every now and then so they'd be happy. All of this is very cynical, but that's the way it really was. When you bring ethics and morals and all sorts of high sacrosanct principles into matters like these, it generally doesn't work out very well.
But how far could this loss of control go? People are now worrying about Mexico as a narco state. People are talking about failed state, talking about Somalia for parts of Mexico now as a parallel. What do you make of that?
I think that's a huge exaggeration, Tom. I don't think that was ever true before, and it's certainly not true now. What is true is that by bringing out the army, almost all of it, to fight the cartels in certain areas of the country, by trying to use what's left of the municipal, state, and federal police also in that war, law and order overall has diminished, because there's nobody left to go after the people who hold you up in the street or steal your car or enter your house at night. Firstly. Secondly, yes, there is a problem of territorial control in certain parts, but, for example, the case of Juarez, which is a city of 1.5 million people, has had more than 10,000 Mexican troops patrolling its streets for more than a year now, a year and a half, and it's worse than ever. So it's not clear that the presence of the army means control, and that the absence of the army doesn't mean control. Mexico City, which is arguably the largest city in the world, is a perfectly relatively safe city, not much different from most American cities or other. It's much safer than any city in Latin America. And there's no army patrolling its streets, and there's, for practical purposes, not much of a police force either. All of these things are very relative. Using hyperbole like Somalia, failed state, war on drugs, organized crime, taking this all the way as far as everything is necessary, I'm not sure all of that takes us anywhere.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Mexico and the reach of the drug cartels. Just how deep, just how murderous in Mexico and Latin America, at this point in the USA. We've been joined, and happy to be so, from Vail, Colorado, by Jorge Castaneda, former Mexican foreign minister from 2000 to 2003. We've got him for just a few more minutes here. Sam Logan is with us as well, journalist and security analyst, founding editor of Southern Pulse Networked Intelligence. Mr. Castaneda calls for and about your comments there. Josh in Omaha, Nebraska. Josh, you're on the air with the former foreign minister of Mexico.
Hey, it's good to talk to you, Tom. And great topic today, by the way.
Good.
Now, I was listening to the speech that was just going on, the discussion on the crime going on in Mexico, the troubles with the drug war.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat there and listened and heard a lot of conflicting statements. If not about, you know, we're against having the military here. I'm against having the military here. But, you know, drugs are bad, and we're all about appeasing the drug lords originally. You know, I think if you're going to make a stand one way or the other on the drug problem in Mexico, you have to pick a plan and stick to it. I mean, I understand if it's not working, it's not working. But to say one thing and do another and to be against it, but to be doing things that are encouraging a lot of these activities, I really struggle with that.
Josh, let us pick it up. Jorge Castaneda, you hear Josh's, here's your criticism of the drug war. You say it's ineffective, but here's your response as appeasement. Make a stand, he says. Stick with it.
Well, I would tend to agree with it. I'm not sure I'd use the word appeasement. I like modus vivendi, accommodation, live and let live better than others. I understand that's a lot what the United States is doing, for example, in Afghanistan. I'm not sure that the 100,000 troops, U.S. troops in Afghanistan, are combating the poppy growers or the heroin producers, which make Afghanistan the single largest producer of heroin in the world. They're combating Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and they're using the poppy growers partly as allies. I guess that's appeasement there. Then, similarly, I'm not sure exactly what you do in most U.S. cities with consumption of drugs, with prostitution, or even, for that matter, with illegal immigration. The last I heard, the United States had not deployed the army at the border to stop illegal mm-hmm. immigration from mm-hmm. Mexico, round everybody up and throw them out. Why? Because it's not possible. It's too expensive. It violates American principles. It's not done. So this notion that you have to make a stand on drugs, I think is false. I agreed with what I heard Sam saying a while ago, that legalization or decriminalization is not a quick fix, but it's certainly a good place to start. And marijuana is a good place to start because, at least according to American official sources, 60 to 70% of the profits for the Mexican cartels come from the marijuana trade. I'd like to know what's going to happen with Mexico. What are we going to do if in November the voters of California vote in favor of the proposition to legalize or decriminalize possession, consumption, and regulated sale of marijuana? So we're going to keep having our people die on the southern side of the border to stop Mexican marijuana from entering the U.S., where once it enters, it can be consumed legally in California?
Wow, that's a question. Sam Logan, you've been listening to a lot from Jorge Castaneda. What's your thought? He wants to go to a sort of pre-Calderon accommodationist stance instead of war on drugs. It's not perfect, but better than what Mexico has got now. What do you say, Sam?
Well, I think to take some of the points that Mr. Castaneda is making a step further, it's important to consider on the political level with President Calderon that he came in with a very weak mandate. It's one of the reasons why he decided to go after the drug cartels to begin with and begin this bloody fight. He has elections, governor level, mayor level, elections coming up this July. His time in office is limited. He's an incumbent from the moment he entered office. He would like very much for his party to continue in power. So he's looking around the room and trying to figure out his best decision to make at this point. The military, at least in Juarez and other places, at least the army is not doing the job he thought it would do. The Mexican Navy is another matter, though. They've been very successful with some raids. Some of the things that I've been reading coming out of Mexico in terms of accommodation, and I don't think that's the right word, maybe it's political pragmatism, is that the Calderon administration may focus on one group or one alliance of the cartels and then make some sort of agreement with the second group. So that would be that he would focus on taking out the Gulf cartel, the Zetas, and the Juarez cartel, perhaps, And then once those guys are taken care of, he would then try and make some sort of backroom deal with El Chapo Guzman and the Sinaloa Federation. That could be something that could dramatically reduce violence before the end of his term, and politically speaking, ensure the longevity of his party in power, as well as a positive outlook on how his presidency ended up.
Wow. What a scene, playing one cartel against the other. Jorge Castañeda, your perspective has been invaluable today. Agree or not, you really make us think, and we appreciate your time. I know I have to let you go. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Sam.
The former Mexican Foreign Minister, Jorge Castañeda. Sam, we've got lots of callers. Christy, Brantford, Connecticut. Christy, you're on the air.
I just wanted to say that I have family living in northern Mexico, in Reynosa and Laredo, mm-hmm. and I don't know if it's a failed state or not, but I don't know what you call the atmosphere of fear that people are living in. The roads are closed. Any wrong move, you can get in a bad situation where there's like a shootout. There's just such an atmosphere of fear that it reminds me of living in a repressive regimen. So that's even worse than a failed state to me.
Wow.
What I hear about my family.
And that's what they're reporting to you, just fear.
Oh, yeah.
And how, like a little fear, a lot of fear?
A lot of fear. There's just no normality in life. I mean, you can go out in your car, and then in the next street over, there can be a shootout. It is very awful right now what they're experiencing.
Wow, that's...
I don't know what's going to happen in the future. It's sad. It's gotten worse and worse.
So does your family favor the drug war or say lay off it? It's getting worse with the drug war.
You know what? People don't want to give a lot of opinions because... If you speak against the cartels, you can suffer.
That's for sure. Even journalists intimidated and shot when they write or about what's going on. Christy, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Let's get another one right here from Evansville, Indiana. Keith, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hi, Keith.
I just had a comment that may be a little bit off your topic. I started listening about 10 minutes ago.
Okay.
I'm a Vietnam veteran. And in Vietnam, I saw heroin and various hallucinogenics and marijuana commonly, easily obtainable on secure military bases. And at the time, I didn't care. But later, I realized I saw men just destroyed by the drugs, and I realized there was no way that those drugs could get on a secure military base unless part of the chain of command was involved in some way for some reason, and I believe it was for money.
So take us to Mexico, Keith. What do you see?
Well, I believe this. I think that if there was not so much money being made in the United States on the sale of drugs, we would not have as serious a problem as we have. Another experience tells me that when economic times change, certain people who are about to lose their station in life will sometimes become involved on a high level in the trafficking of drugs. These are people with political power and monetary power. And until something is done at that level, there will always be money available to set up these networks.
Keith, it sounds to me like you've watched and learned here, and I'm going to put that to Sam, but look to the power structure. Look to the chain of command. We will pick it up, and I appreciate your call. I want to get one more right here from El Paso, Texas, and Armando. Armando, you're on the air.
Yes, my name is Armando, and I live in El Paso, Texas. Thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Yes, sir.
Well, I was telling the receptionist that I feel that the Mexican authorities are not doing enough to control the cartels of Juarez. We go across once in a while because my wife has a house over there where her mother lives, and we are afraid to go. And, of course, we've also worked with the church over there, and things are not very well now in El Paso. I mean, in Juarez.
So what do you think of the drug war? Is it helping Armando or not?
Well, I don't think they're doing enough. I think they should do, for example, the gentleman mentioned the weapons coming across the border from the United States.
Yep.
They have customs officers when we cross the border. They have their own customs officers there at the border. They have the army there. They could be doing roadblocks and checking people out. Every car, that has a weapon, they need to start arresting people.
Armando, I appreciate your perspective from El Paso, right on the border there with family on both sides. Thanks for your call. Sam, I want to go to the chain of command question that Keith raised, but also first to Armando and the border. I mean, you wrote in a report a couple of years ago now that, you know, the border is had never been more porous, that you've got drugs and humans and you name it coming north, and bulk money, cash, and weapons smuggled back south. You said in this report that it was inevitable that one gang would rise to the top of sort of controlling the border and that that gang would become a sort of mega cartel, potential to earn over $50 billion a year from its control of the border. Has that happened, Sam?
No, I wouldn't say that's happened. But it looks like the conditions right now in terms of looking at the Sinaloa Federation is becoming what I think I may have called a mega cartel, mm-hmm. For lack of a better term. That may come to pass. You have well-entrenched groups in Juarez, for example, and in Tijuana, who are fighting El Chapo. But if they lose, and lose they might, then you would see a situation where the Sinaloa Federation could quite possibly control the border from Mexicali, moving east all the way to Matamoros.
The Senior Law Federation? That sounds like a...
The Sinaloa Federation. Yeah,
Sinaloa,
it's a group of smaller
okay.
drug trafficking organizations. But it's essentially an umbrella group with a very, very structured hierarchical power structure.
And what about our caller, Keith, in Indiana, saying, you know, his experience in Vietnam tells him to look to the chain of command, look to the higher up. I mean, it's a lot of money. How high up in Mexico circles of wealth, how high up in Mexican circles of power does the money flow?
Well, you know, I've talked to journalists who are Mexican, who write for Mexican publications, who live here in D.C. Because of death threats, and they've suggested that, you know, as high as the head of the Mexican Justice Department is on one payroll or another. Last year, we saw the head of Interpol in Mexico had been on the take, receiving tens of thousands of dollars a month. And there's countless levels of middlemen, the people that sort of pass by without being noticed or seen, but who are listening and watching. That's where the corruption in terms of what they call in Mexico a bite, mordida, that's where it gets very, very difficult to combat. And in terms of the military, within the military structure, corruption is much, much lower. That's one of the reasons why the Army still retains a high level of respect throughout Mexico.
So what happens here, Sam? I mean, you heard Jorge Castaneda, the former foreign minister, he should know something what he's speaking of, saying it's an exaggeration to call Mexico a narco state. You know, this failed state stuff goes too far. On the other hand, we've heard a number of people in this hour describe pretty broad swaths of the country where there's not central control. The cartels are in charge, and you're talking about money going all the way to the top. Is there a tolerable sort of balance here, or is this tipping over into something that's intolerable? What do you see coming?
Well, in terms of a failed state or not, I don't think Mexico will ever be a failed state in terms of how people define a failed state, looking at Somalia,
right.
for example, or maybe Haiti. Mm-hmm. The closest thing we have to a failed state besides Haiti in Latin America would perhaps be Guatemala, and that's a whole other matter in terms of what's going on Mexico's southern border. One thing that we've been looking at with some of our people on the southern pole side is the idea of failed cities. Reynosa, one of your callers, Christy, mentioned that there's an absolute state of fear in Reynosa. Journalists are being kidnapped. People are not going to school and not sending their children to school. That is perhaps something that could look like a failed city in the future. Juarez is certainly a good candidate for that as well. Tijuana, we thought maybe would go in that direction, but they seem to have turned a corner. Moving forward, though, if you look downstream, if you will, at where Mexico is headed today, it doesn't seem to me that the Calderon administration or the Mexican army or federal police, for that matter, alone are going to be able to capture control and what I would consider a monopoly on lethal force throughout the country. When you have someone like Secretary Clinton come down to Mexico City and very publicly and absolutely take ownership for the United States part of this situation, then I think what we have politically speaking is a setup for something longer term, something that may look more like Planned Columbia did when Clinton, President Clinton, was talking about it in 2000, and a long-term engagement that is not necessarily military-heavy, but heavy in terms of training, heavy in terms of support, and certainly heavy on the clandestine side in terms of developing human intelligence assets and other sort of these cloak and dagger type methods that were used in Colombia that helped break up the cartels in Colombia through the 90s.
How much of the war then with the drug cartels do you think may come to rest on American shoulders?
I think the deeper and the longer we remain involved in Mexico, the more the Mexican government may come to rely on the United States, as a Colombian government did, come to rely on the United States for continued assistance. What we do not know, some of the wild cards here, are, number one, who will replace Calderón as the next president of Mexico? Mm-hmm. If someone from the PRI, the party who was in power for maybe 70 years or so, if that president comes to power, then we may see a complete disengagement with the United States, sort of a nationalistic fervor, and one whereby some sort of accommodation agreement is reached with El Chapo Guzman and the Sinaloa Federation. That would dramatically reduce violence.
Is that tolerable for the United States? After all, this is right on its border. The U.S. is complicit here. That's clear. On the other hand, you know, how much chaos and lethal non-governmental power can any state tolerate on its right on its border?
Well, in terms of tolerance, Tom, I think it's important to consider that the only reason why we're talking about Mexico today is because the Americans were killed in Juarez a couple weekends ago. If you think about tolerance in politics in Washington, it's very fickle. It's very fleeting. Mexico is in the headlines today, but tomorrow it's going to be somewhere else. As long as the violence remains down, then there's no perceived threat.
Fascinating and deadly. Samuel Logan with Southern Pulse Networked Intelligence. Thank you very much for your time and insights this hour, Sam. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, for the invitation.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.